Hi, I'm Maureen Metcalf. Welcome to Innovative Leaders Driving Thriving Organizations. I am your host for the show. I'm the founder and CEO of Metcalf & Associates. I work with leaders and their organizations, identifying the trends that will most likely disrupt their business and develop business strategies and business and leadership practices to leverage those trends to create strategic advantage. I'm a regular contributor to Forbes and the lead author on an award-winning book series focusing on innovating how you lead and transforming your organizations. I'm also an adjunct faculty member of universities in the U.S. and Germany, and I am delighted to be joined by Mark Palmer and Belinda Gore, the two primary authors on the book series. It is the first time in over 100 interviews that the three of us have been together, which is really quite a shame. So, Belinda Gore, PhD, is a psychologist, coach, and experienced teacher skilled in supporting high-level learning and personal development. As a senior faculty with the Deep Coaching Institute, she uses the Enneagram system, along with 30 years of experience in facilitating change, to help coaches and leadership consultants learn to embody deep level of transformation through the practice of presence. While specific tools may assist them in their work, it is the very presence that most often initiates the extraordinary shifts in consciousness in individuals and organizations that is the foundation for deep change. Belinda played a key role in defining the innovative leadership framework and contributing to the 9 books. Mark Palmer is a principal and advisor with Metcalf & Associates. He is also a co-author of The Field Book and the co-creator of Position Success Indicator and Labor Genome, performance mapping solutions. He's an expert in professional development and on the use of data intelligence to solve organizational challenges. Mark also has over 20 years of corporate experience in strategic planning, team development, market research, and data analysis. So my goal for this radio show, Innovative Leaders Driving Thriving Organizations, is to help you as our listeners identify areas where you can address the challenges that you're facing today and provide information that will help you navigate it and thrive during these times of change. So we are now saying basically we need to make ourselves become perpetual innovation machines. I need to have the capacity not only to update myself once, but to do it on an ongoing basis, because we as leaders and people in organizations are facing multiple concurrent changes, and it will never get slower. So imagine that today is the slowest day you will ever have in your life, rest of your life.
Oh, great.
And that leads us into our topic of resilience. So we'd like our listeners to expand their understanding of resilience overall, how it connects to stress, and how we can measure it and build it. In the context that the world is getting more challenging, the speed isn't going away, and the things that we are facing as people is often getting more complicated as well. All of us need resilience, and I know one of my personal fears is what happens when I just can't keep up anymore with the pace, whether it's my laptop or my tasks. And some might argue I don't do so well anyway. So let's start with the definition of what is resilience. Do you want to kick us off, Belinda?
Sure. We talk about resilience as a term that we borrow from engineering, and it's just how much pressure a material can endure before it is changed irrevocably. That's the piece that kind of sounds somber, really, but we know that things are always experiencing pressure, and we're always experiencing pressure and stress. But it's how much can we manage before we break, whatever that might mean. Mm-hmm. And so our resilience is our capacity to keep coming back in the face of pressure of any variety.
And in some cases, we learn from it, right? We hope.
We hope we do all the time. I'm going on a hiking trip, and so I'm in my own version of training. And my massage therapist, who I crawl to periodically, says, muscles stretch, and they tear, and they ache, and then they build capacity. And that's really what we're doing all the time. We're stretching. You know, there's a tearing that goes on, and it hurts. If we do it too much, we can damage ourselves. But that process of stretching and stretching and stretching really is intended to build our capacity.
You know, I was talking to a client today who recounted a story about getting fired years ago and how painful, emotionally painful, and yet how he is a much more competent CEO at this point than he would have been had he not gone through that.
Mm. Right.
But there's nothing.
At the moment, you know, it's like, no, this hurts too much. I can't endure it. I can't survive it. And part of what we talk about with resilience is how to build our capacity and also how to take an attitude toward it so that we're not seeing ourselves as collapsing, but being able to be objective enough about what's going on, how do I need to take care of myself, but also how am I growing in the midst of it?
We talked about in the book, and Belinda is the primary author of all of the resilience work, so the idea of staying flexible and focused. And I have a picture when I speak to groups of a little boy looking through his legs, so bending over.
Right.
It is something we don't demonstrate in public. But but the idea that it's almost like a downward dog pose, that no matter how I have to contort myself to navigate the situation, am I still able to keep my eyes on true north, stay true to my values, and help the organization or the client go in the direction they're intending to go?
What I like about that slide, which we've used a number of times, is he's getting a different perspective. You know, it looks like he's contorted, but in fact, he's seeing things in a different way. And hopefully, under stressful conditions, we have the capacity to shift our perspective.
And there are times I feel like I'm standing on my head.
Yeah.
Just nothing makes sense. So how is it relevant in business? And Mark, you and I are working on a resilience tool. So how are you mapping what we're doing there to business environments?
I think part of the opportunity for understanding resilience more tangibly, Belinda noted that resilience as a capacity. And so one of the things is drilling into capacity. What does that mean as something that we can start to build in a more measurable way? So part of what we're trying to do with the assessment is say, what does measurable capacity, and I'm going to add something to this, the ability to be responsive to that stress, and how can we measurably create optimal response to the stress that we get day in and day out? So one of the things with the assessment is that there are different types of response. There's different types of emotional response, physical response, mental response, intuitive response. And there is not one configuration that is quote unquote right. There are multiple optimals. And so part of what we want to do with the upgraded assessment is provide that range of where are we optimal in some areas of response and where do we have and experience gaps? And so how can we create an optimized response that allows us the opportunity to receive this stressful feedback in the most beneficial way possible?
I like that, the idea that, and each of us has a different kind of mapping of our capacity.
Yes.
And when we're sleep deprived, we have a different mapping.
Yes. A much different mapping when we're sleep deprived, for sure.
So, Belinda, we've talked about the impact of stress and resilience. Can you talk a little bit about why the negative impact of stress and how resilience helps us?
Well, let's start out talking about the nervous system, that we have an autonomic or automatic nervous system that has three branches, really. We're more familiar with the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, and the third branch is the enteric. The enteric is the brain and the belly, which there's lots of interesting research about how we collect data and organize it and process it and learn from it and make decisions and solve problems in our bellies without our conscious awareness. Yes. And so when people are under stress, too much stress, what do we get? You know, we get irritable bowel syndrome and indigestion and all those things. So that's one kind of awareness. But this sympathetic, parasympathetic is like the accelerator and the brakes. So we're designed neurologically in the face of something. Stress is really a response to change. So any kind of change in the environment will create some kind of stress as we're alert to what do we need to do. And the very ancient response is, do we fight or do we flee? But both of those require the accelerator to get us moving. Parasympathetic is the brakes that slows us down, lets us rest, regenerate, stay in balance. Sometimes we're just trying to keep the accelerator on all the time. And if we don't bring in the opportunity to rest, have relaxation, think about other kinds of things, have interpersonal relationships, then we're just driving, driving, driving. And that sets up problems in our body system that lead to physiological disorders. You know, and we all know that stress is the cause of lots of kinds of problems, at least a lowered immune system response, and at worst, you know, things like heart disease and cancer and so forth.
And also psychological?
Well, indeed, that the tendency is either too much acceleration, we're irritable. Too much brake or needing to brake, we get depressed. So anxiety and depression are the two major psychological problems everywhere. And those are those two basic reactions.
I worked with two different clients who both had serious psychological breakdowns. And now they came back to work. But it took a while. And in both cases, they were leading significant change efforts for large, complex organizations. And my guess is it was never putting on the brakes. And then the body stopped.
And you know, you remember we've talked about the research from, the 80s when AT&T had to dissemble. And the research, a nurse actually, Dr. Kolbasa, as I recall her name is, she tracked how people were dealing with losing their jobs, being downsized, being transferred, all that sort of thing. And there was this small part of the population who actually thrived in the midst of all of this change. Mm. And that was the beginning of our understanding that stress doesn't have to be debilitating, but we have to know how to deal with it in order for it to take us into that next level instead of burying ourselves.
So that's a great lead-in then. What are the four elements of resilience that came out of that research?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I'm going to have to look at some notes here. All right. That's not really it. But there were three C's.
Ah, okay.
And for the life of me, I can't think about it. But how we translated it, we ended up talking about how important it is to deal with taking care of ourselves physically, managing ourselves emotionally, which is also the biggest thing is to have a sense of purpose and a commitment to a belief system that makes what we're going through meaningful. And then also to stay interpersonally connected. We apparently need each other. And when people drop their ability to interact well with others, they just don't do as well. So her research said that the three C's were, we developed an attitude that challenge is positive, that it's good for us to go through difficult things, that we do have control over ourselves, how we respond, the choices we make. We may not have control over the world, but we can keep making decisions for ourselves. We're not victims, basically. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, having a commitment to a belief system of some variety, it doesn't matter what it is, that gives a sense of meaning to what we're going through.
Great. So then the four elements that we talk about in the framework are, I can manage my physical well-being, and most of us know what that is. Many of us don't get enough sleep.
Right. It's amazing. The research says that normal adults need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep every night. And I teach this stuff and people roll their eyes or whatever. And I say, okay, stop caffeine for 2 weeks and come back and tell me how you can do it on 5 hours of sleep. And that's really the issue, that we medicate ourselves to be able to not get as much sleep as our bodies need.
And anyone who knows me knows I am massively guilty. So I'm going to run through these real quickly, then we'll go on break and we'll come back and talk more about them. So maintaining physical well-being, managing my thinking, having a sense of purpose and emotional intelligence is number 3. And then number 4 is harnessing the power of connection.
Right.
And so you mentioned those before. We'll go to break at this point and we'll come back and talk more about those and how it shows up in business and why we care. Welcome back to Innovative Leaders Driving Thriving Organizations. Today we are with Belinda Gore and Mark Palmer, and we are talking about resilience. We've talked about the four elements, so I'll repeat them. Physical well-being, managing thinking, having a clear sense of purpose and emotional intelligence, and managing connections. So Belinda's going to walk us through a little bit more about what each of those things mean.
I always say we start with the body, because in the end, the body wins. You know, we can push ourselves and pretend that we don't need to take care of ourselves, but sooner or later, the body wins. So we talked about needing sleep. We talk about needing to feed ourselves well. It's always interesting. We see these reports of new research that the best way to deal with, you know, name it, cancer, heart disease, anything.
Nutrition, is, sleep.
Yeah, get enough sleep, exercise, and good nutrition. Well, duh. So that's what we need. In order to be resilient, we need to be able to feed ourselves well, get some exercise. And it doesn't have to be a major workout. It can be taking a walk in the neighborhood, or doing
steps a day.
Right. Yeah. Doing some
walking
stretches. Yeah. All those kinds of things. Also, the truth is sometimes we medicate ourselves with alcohol. Sometimes we medicate ourselves with food.
We do.
And with smoking. And, you know, those are all ways that we're trying to hide from ourselves the fact that our bodies are needing care. So at risk of sounding like I'm lecturing, it's just we need to be nice to ourselves. And the more we're nice to our bodies, the longer we'll be able to be resilient. The next issue about the beliefs that we have, the idea that we shouldn't have to suffer is one of the things that gets so many people in trouble, because we'll be going through whatever we're going through, and then we have this voice that says, I shouldn't have to be doing this, or he shouldn't be treating me this way, or whatever.
My boss is mean.
And
my spouse
those
is mean.
Shoulds and shouldn't be this way distract us from turning our attention to, so it's going on anyway, how can I deal with it in the most effective way possible? Mm-hmm. So it's that basic attitude that challenges aren't bad for us.
Yeah, I want to interject here. We did, a 3-interview series with Gary Weber, who talked a lot, well, for 3 hours, about managing what the neuroscience says about managing the brain and managing our thinking. Mm-hmm. And for people who want to dive deeper into that, it's really a very helpful interview series, just how our brain ratchets up the negatives to keep us from, you know, being dead, to make sure we put our pants on before we leave the house, you know, those kinds of patterns. And when something goes wrong, our brain escalates it, so that we are attending to those potential negatives in a way that will keep us from
sure.
perishing.
Mm-hmm. And I love the word, we perseverate. You know, 98% of what's going on can be great. And we look at that 2% and we won't let it go. We won't keep it in balance mm-hmm. with everything else. And that is a developmental issue that kept us alive so that mm-hmm. our ancestors who were able to see the problems and solve them survived. But now we've taken it to a fine art that is not so fine after all, it seems. So then, yeah, the other area about emotional well-being, really, we talked about this notion that if we have a sense of purpose, if we have a belief that what's going on is meaningful and we find the meaning, then what that it gives us is we don't resist what's happening emotionally. We also don't fall into it. But mm-hmm. we can allow ourselves to feel the big five: sad, mad, glad, alone, or afraid. And we're feeling those feelings all the time. If we allow ourselves to just notice it and have it and not get freaked out about it, then really we utilize our emotions to help us stay on purpose. And then finally is interpersonal relationships. You probably know this statistic better than I do about people who have at least one good friend in the workplace are how many percentages more productive? It's an amazing amount.
If you don't have a best friend at work, there's only an 8% chance, if I'm getting this right, coming from Gallup, that you'll be fully engaged.
Right.
8%.
Yeah.
So and, that connection.
Right. So it doesn't mean everybody has to be all touchy-feely all the time, although some people are more naturally interpersonally engaged. There's not one standard. It is just that when we talk with someone, when we take time off for lunch to go have lunch with somebody or take a walk with a friend at lunch, mm-hmm. or we have somebody we can talk things over with and they understand what's going on and we feel safe with them, then the amygdala in the brain is not firing danger, 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 and we're better able to keep our balance. Mm-hmm. And not see everything as a threat.
So one statistic that I use a lot, 5 minutes of negative thinking causes 6 hours of physiological impact.
Wow. Yeah.
And so if I feel like I am under siege, mm-hmm. and there are workplaces I've certainly felt that, mm-hmm. that negativity is firing all the time. Mm-hmm. And for people who know me know I drive probably exceedingly fast. so I have had more than one instance of, you know, a mattress flying off a truck in front of me or something and having to swerve. And not too long ago, a Christmas tree fell off in front of
oh,
me.
Oh, great.
Something about things
random.
Flying off.
Yeah. And there's immediately it could go through my windshield and kill me. I can swerve to the right and hit somebody, or I can swerve to the left and hit somebody. And that immediate adrenaline rush is my brain is responding more quickly than I'm conscious of. I exit that scenario feeling like I've just been chased by a pack of wild dogs or something.
But, you know, there are a lot of people in big positions who are addicted to that adrenaline rush, who seek it out. And who push for it. And
who cause other people to have it.
That's right. And so while they may need a certain level of stimulation in order to feel alive, mm-hmm. for the rest of us, we have waves of stress hormones like cortisol mm-hmm. that don't do us any favors in terms of the well-being of our bodies.
And so the reason I bring it up, and I appreciate your point that some people cause it more than others
yeah.
and those around them. And I'm wondering, I hope I'm not one of them.
One thing that Belinda brings to mind is this notion that these things can be used as tools, that they're signals and they can be utilized in experience, that they're the big five that Belinda talked about, you know, these elements that we experience emotionally, are not just passive things that we experience that can be in, that are just endured, but they're actually, they can be intentional tools for us to respond in a different way, because experience is messy, and the capacity to accept that messiness offers an opportunity for us to use things like anxiety and depression as signals to accelerate or break. So maybe some of these individuals that thrive off of the adrenaline rush, there may be an imbalance somewhere. And so now we can start to use these things and create a methodology to say, there's an intervention here. There's an opportunity for intervention because there's some type of pattern expressed through that behavior that means that there may be gaps in some places, or there may be too much of an expression of some other emotional thing elsewhere. So there's opportunities there for us to reframe resilience as the capacity to, one, accept the messiness of life and experience, but then use the content of experience as intentional tools to help us constantly stay in balance, to navigate, to work the dials, so to speak. We have a gauge now. We can use these as gauges of our experience.
And our body's one of the barometers that tells us
it's
out of balance.
Yes, big barometer. Totally, yeah.
I like the idea of reframing, and I think, Belinda, you brought it up first, and Mark, you did a beautiful job of crystallizing that if we step out of the idea that life is, stuff's not supposed to go wrong, but it just, it is the nature of things.
Yeah.
Stuff breaks.
Stuff breaks. It's a huge piece of the capacity, and Belinda touched on it throughout the conversation. I think it's a very, very big first step, the ability to not be in a reactive position, but then now we're starting at least to exercise. So in terms of something tangible, now it becomes, this becomes a tangible piece as, what can I do? So a lot of times we say, well, what can I do to become more resilient? Well, the first thing is we can build acceptance of experience as is. That becomes a very tangible first